You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahi ahi mari e, tēnā koutou katoa, ko me e toka ingoa.
Ko Sophia toku ingoa. No mai haere mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. Kia ora mea, how are you this week?
I'm good, how are you my lovely?
I'm good, I'm so sleepy this morning though.
I know, we're both a little bit sleepy mode.
We're both like, we've been sat in silence for the last like hour.
We've been locked in.
Yeah.
Maybe I need a coffee, I think
I think that might be the go. that might be us.
Yes.
But what have we got on the show today?
Yeah, I caught up with Jude Stevens about his solo exhibition Goldie's Grove, which is currently on at Room Gallery. So what have you got today?
I caught up with artist Claudia Jowett about her solo exhibition Ualevu, currently on at Melanie Roger Gallery.
Yeah, aha, ofakara, we'd love to hear your thoughts on these pieces. So tuku patahi mai, you can text us on 5395 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5
also after the show koa e ware ware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki enei kōrero anō hei pakihere roki roki maronga i te pai toku toku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakoti.com. You can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Oh, that's a good art!
Claudia Jauer is a tamaki-based maker whose practice explores the sculptural possibilities of paint, moving between the two and three-dimensional, employing a myriad of tools and kitchen implements from icing bags and decorator tips to tile grouting combs to squeeze, manipulate and build paint onto her canvas. Paint, shells, coral, mussy and seaweed layered like sedimentary rock, forming these beautiful webs of delicate pastels, Jowett pushes the boundaries of traditional definitions of what makes a painting, challenging the constraints of the canvas and frame and these rhythms of movement. Her current solo exhibition at Melanie Roger Gallery, Ualevu, follows on from her recent solo presentation at the Douse in Wellington, Oana, Carried by the Waves, presenting her work in a variety of forms, some more as paintings, others more as sculpture, as well as cyanotypes too. I had a kōrero with Claudia Jowett about Ualevu and her wider practice.
Kia ora, my name is Claudia Jowett. I'm a painter of sorts and I work as an educator and in arts advocacy. In terms of the things that inform my practice, I'm very much sort of in the abstract painting kind of area, but sort of increasingly pushing towards work that sits somewhere between sculpture and painting. That's more informed by my dad's Fijian heritage, and it sitting somewhere, like informed by sort of heritage practices, but looking at it in a more contemporary version of that as someone of kind of mixed heritage, Kailoma, which means someone of Itoke and Valangi heritage. So that kind of is reflected in the work and what informs it as well.
Your current exhibition at Melanie Roger Gallery, Ualevu, follows from your Douse show, Oana, Carried by the Waves, your first solo exhibition in a public gallery. To begin with speaking about the show at Melanie Roger, would you like to start to speak a little about the Douse show? How did this project come about and what's it like for you to bring the show up to Tamaki now?
Oh yeah, so the Douse show was a really positive experience. It was working with Carl Chittam, who's the director and was my curator, and it came from a conversation of like looking back at works that I'd made in Fiji or collected stuff from Fiji since I think the earliest was 2016, and it went to new work that was made. It had 51 works in it that moved through a variety of mediums like watercolors, cyanotypes, paintings, sort of more sculptural pieces, and it was this idea of kind of building a breadth of how the sort of the current work and gestures towards what come next, like a base of where that had all come from, and then positioning it in terms of the cultural connections and as this kind of gesture towards a Yeah, a painting practice that sits somewhere between sculpture and painting.
I wanted to ask a little bit more about, I guess, that style. Your practice largely explores the sculptural possibilities of paint, moving between the two and three dimensional, employing all sorts of tools and kitchen implements from icing bags and decorator tips to tile grouting combs to squeeze, manipulate and build paint onto your canvas. I'd love to know a little bit about how you first came across this way of making. Where did the signature style of yours come from?
When I was doing my undergraduate and then my honours at AUT, I'd kind of been looking at really pared, eventually I'd got to this point of very pared back abstraction practice, like sort of the Agnes Martin style, working really a lot with mainly whites that were tinted. I still kind of have that quite pastel approach, but then by the time I'd come to do my master's at Elam, I became quite interested in this, like, the do's and don'ts of, like, what a serious painting practice is and what the difference between, like, craft or, like, woman's work and all these kind of distinctions and hierarchies that the art world makes. And coming from that thing where you're constantly looking at, in the beginning, more encouraged to look, you know, to America and to Europe as, you know, predominantly, I was looking at quite a lot of female, but, you know, there's this abstract expressionist, very male-dominated canon.
Mm.
And I became quite interested in craft and woman's work and the domestic and, yeah, this thing of, like, kitchen tools as painting and, like, doing the wrong things, using pastel colours that were kind of kitschy and, like, that, I think it came from this element of, I don't know, this slight, I shouldn't swear, but kind of punk kind of element where I was like, I want to kind of butt up against what could be considered as serious abstract painting. And as, like, a female, what are the rules that I could sort of break a little bit, you know? Like, there was, like, I loved, you know, I still love Judy Darrow, but I remember looking at her work when I was a kid and just being like, whoa, the queen of camp and, like, kitchen, you know, that thing of, like, leaning into this, using the haberdashery and the stuff around the house and collecting things and it all kind of forming the substrate of that you build stuff off of. So that was where it kind of started. And then it involved reconnecting with my dad's family back in Fiji, that really started to fold back into the work. So I guess it started from trying to do the wrong things.
How can I do what I'm told not to do?
Exactly right.
Perfect. That's beautiful. Yeah, I definitely want to talk a little bit more about some of the ideas you pointed to there. But you mentioned at the beginning you called yourself a painter of sorts. And I'd love to kind of talk a little bit more about that. Would you consider yourself as a painter or more of a sculptural artist? Does that title change depending on the form of canvas you use?
Yeah, I don't even think I would say I would call myself a sculptor. I think it's just this weird kind of, I don't know, whether it's like maybe I sit somewhere in being a maker. I don't know, like, yeah, I grew up in quite a creative family. My mum was a seamstress and a pattern maker. My dad was a draftsman. And this whole thing of, like, what creative practice isn't it really coming back to making constantly? I don't know, there can be this kind of, like, yes, I'm a painter, but also I am a painter. You know, it can feel quite, I don't know, maybe it's a weird little hang up I've got. Like, the making thing is, like, to me it just comes back to this constant process of making as opposed to painting. It's like, I am a painter, but I'm also using a lot of different materials that aren't just paint. Yes, maybe that's what it is. I don't know. Maybe I need to talk to a psychologist or something.
It's a bit of everything, actually. Yeah. No, I guess I was just thinking about that because, you know, you spoke about earlier how you're in art school and you're learning about these traditional ideas of what a painting is.
Yes.
And I feel like your practice maybe tries to push the boundaries of these. Do you feel like your practice might challenge the typical understanding of how we define a painting in that sense?
I think they're not necessarily, like, well-behaved. Maybe that's the thing. And I'm not always that well behaved. I think there's this, maybe the thing that started to, I pushed these paintings into these really passive, initially when I was making works, where they were very quiet and unassuming and you really had to work to kind of get them to, I know it sounds kind of funny, but open up in a way as to what was going on. Whereas I was like, what if you do the complete opposite? And they're quite, like, I quite like pastels potentially being assertive pastels as opposed to it being this thing of, like, pastels are soft and, you know. So the colour thing is quite intentional. There's also that thing of it riffing off, because where my dad's from is, like, on the coral reefs and, like, the amount of time I've spent out there. So inevitably some of those colours are informing it. But I think that thing of it, like, them being quite assertive, you know, and then pushing out into the form. They're pushing out through the frame. They're kind of leaping off the traditional substrate is definitely part of that, like, trying to test just where they want to go a little bit.
Yeah, I feel like you've, like, kind of played more and more into that as well, kind of going beyond the frame throughout the years. Have you tried to lean more into that as you've gone through your practice?
Yeah, I've definitely tried to do some more, like, I've cast a full painting in bronze before, so expensive, Jesus or do sort of things in fiberglass. There was a thing where sometimes you lost the tactility, which I just enjoy making as well. It sounds silly, but that thing of, like, handicraft or like embellishment, like the thing in the with Pacific practices where it's like adornment is a big thing, that thing of referencing the natural world, natural elements, and those things being like with Musi, which is Fijian tapa, where all the mark making and the forms represent elements from the natural world that are then formed into a language, because it wasn't, Wasavakaviti Fijian language wasn't a written thing until missionaries came. It was a visual, you know, like that storytelling was oratory, but then there was also translated into visual storytelling.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that you spoke on it a little bit earlier, but I think that in maybe reclaiming these historical masculine notions of pure painting and using kitchen tools, which traditionally have been associated with women and domesticity, that there might be something to be said for your work as being a form of challenge to traditional views of femininity. Are you able to talk a little bit more to, I guess, that consideration that goes behind the work in that respect?
Yeah, I think maybe with craft practices and also with female, you know, if you look through the canon of art history, there is a little bit of a lack of representation, or things even with like textile practices, which are being kind of more recognized now, things that maybe like were more viewed through a woman's lens, or stuff that could be fit around a domestic setting. But to me, there's like there's this rich kind of tapestry of like all these amazing female practitioners, like here in New Zealand. I love Tiawani Tipo's work, who she started painting in her 80s, sort of telling stories of the Pacific through her painting. She's being much more recognized now, but for a long time, you know, in the canon of New Zealand art history, she wasn't necessarily, you know, or like Scylla McQueen or Anne McCann, you know, Scylla was Ralph Hotere's partner. You know, there's all these amazing women practitioners as well who might be having to fit their practices around the domestic or, you know, restrictions of like being a mother or fitting around work or the economies of scale and all that sort of stuff. So it's like, why would my work not reflect that back, you know, the challenges of some of those things? And also this amazing lineage of female practitioners and women that have influenced me, like the makers in my family, the woman makers in my family.
I'd love to hear more about those influences though that you mentioned there, women before you and your family.
My mum was a costume maker, a pattern maker, was always making at home. She still is, you know, rag rugs and beaded curtains and us costumes. And my grandmother was a painter. She always painted, and it was always this making, knitting, doing kind of that was fit around daily life. And so that kind of thing has been modeled really strongly to me, as well as my dad. When he would be drawing, doing as a architectural draftsman in the shed at night, and mum would be off making something in her shed or knitting or spinning wool or like, I think that's always been, that making process has always been really strong in my family, and that's important and valid as well, I guess.
Born with it, ingrained. Born this way. I'd love to hear a bit more about your process as well. Before beginning a work, is there a process of pre-sketching the form it will take or anything, or is it more of an intuitive process where you feel led by the material in the moment?
I've definitely switched to try to work in series a little bit, where I will provide a treatment to a number of works. So like the Theba the Shell works, I'll do a series of those at one time. They'll all come out different, but there'll be certain layering processes that are undertaken across a number of works. It will be like, generally I might start off with like airbrush or paint or kind of some sort of drawing, and then it will move into a process of like accumulating things like vul, which is chopped up and kind of disseminated in patterns, which is like a hibiscus bark from Fiji, and then like white musi, which is tapa. There might be crab shell, power shell, you know, it's kind of these, I kind of think of it as the sedimentary process that builds. And I've got a raving too much gene, so I don't know when to switch off. So that it's more this process of like layer, 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 and what does finish look like? Who even knows? I guess it's just reaches a point. Finish is always a little bit tricky because overcooking is so easy.
Yeah.
But it's that thing of like, I've definitely done it where you like conceal everything and you're like, oop, this is an impenetrable spiky fortress. But I think, yeah, I've been trying to like, I think with the douse doing this large work, which I haven't done in a while because I work at home on a little table, a 2.4 meter one was quite good again, where I could like expand it out and really pull that kind of netting of like lots of layers out to reveal like, oh, there's all this other stuff hidden in there sometimes. But yeah, I use like a variety. Like I always grew up with mum having collections of things, of shells, of, you know, all of her making stuff that I go and raid and put into my work as well. So I'm definitely got some strange sort of magpie affliction.
I love that. Yeah. You said that you struggle with kind of finding that end point and that process. Does it tend to just be like a gut feeling for you?
Yeah, it's the sort of point where you talk about it a bit when you're with students or whatever, where it's like, when have you solved the problem too much? And it becomes a little bit uninteresting or a bit dead. There's sort of like a tension between leaving enough open or enough interest that it can hook people in and that it's still kind of alive to when you've pushed it into the little bit dead territory. And you don't really know you've done it till you've done it, which sounds ridiculous, but it kind of
if
is,
you know,
like,
you know.
Oop. I probably shouldn't have worked on that till 3 a.m. because now it's gone quite strange. it's never really fully resolved. And I think that there can be a thing sometimes if you've undertaken a process enough where it becomes easy. I think that is can be a bit of like you've solved the riddle too much. So now you're in a sort of a production mode as opposed to a making mode. I don't know if that makes sense, but yeah, that it's still got a level of unsolvedness in some ways.
Yeah, leave a little bit open for interpretation.
Yeah. I think sometimes if you do too much and you've put a bow on it, it's not really that interesting anymore. Like some of the stuff that I've made where I've been like, oh my God, that's awful. What is that? And I've put it away and then come back to it and you're like, oh.
Yeah, leaving a bit of space.
Yeah, I think it's a constantly shifting goalpost, right? But you just have to, I think with my process, the too much thing can easily push something over into that territory.
Will you, if you feel like you've entered into too much territory, will you scrap it or will you try to recontextualize it for yourself?
Yeah, I think it's just keep going and going until it's gone a bit weird again.
Perfect.
Yeah, that's a good question, Sophia. Who knows?
Who knows? I have no answer. I feel like we've weaved through our conversation a lot that a large part of your work is also the incorporation of these shells, coral, mussy, and seaweed inlaid into the surfaces thick with paint, resin, and other mediums, bringing your Fijian heritage into the work. Are you able to speak a little bit more to this inclusion and this thread of whakapapa in your work?
Yeah, I think that particularly came from the shift that I had in my work where it's kind of like, I'd gone to study in the States during my undergraduate, and I think that helped with this reflection of like, oh, I'm not painting here, you know, like where the art history lineage you might be looking at is quite firmly based in America or Europe or something like that. I'm painting in the South Pacific. And what does that mean to be an abstract painter in the South Pacific? To me, that's more interesting and more relevant to me. And I think sometimes you just need a bit of that perspective, and spending time in Fiji where I was like, at first I thought, oh, this isn't going to change my painting practice at all. Yeah, I was an idiot. And of course it did. You know, inevitably what you're experiencing there and the new materials you're exposed to and the colors and the sights and the sound, they do flow back into your work. So I think it was that thing, the reconnection was evidenced in the work. And there was this thing, I think, this idea of like waterways is really important between, we're all connected by waterways in the South Pacific. And where my dad's from. It's on the coastline of Vanuatu, and it was just, I spent so much time on the reefs there, and it was this thing of like, yeah, using materials from the shorelines, materials from that area, actively embedding them, and then materials from here as well, where it was like, it has the whenua, the kind of the lineage embedded into the work.
Mm.
I think that was why it was this kind of gesture towards place.
Mm. Yeah. Does it feel kind of autobiographical in any sense, like an insertion of yourself?
Inevitably, yeah. Right? There's kind of, I was talking to someone where I was like, oh, you know, I'm an abstract painter, blah, 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 firmly in the abstract. And they're like, there is an element of you're using real, like representational painting, like because you are using real materials. So I was like, oh, kind of, yeah, I guess this sort of is where it's like you are directly using the material in your work that represents an object, a thing, a place. Yeah, and I did, I think the more I resisted the work being autobiographical, the more it became autobiographical. Like I used to operate thinking that work was completely separate from myself. What an idiot.
Yeah. It came over you.
Yeah, it came for me, yep.
Yeah. It happens. I also hear that you are the new Tylee Cottage artist in residence for the Sargent Gallery in Whanganui. Congratulations. Can you tell me a little bit about that residency and what you plan to do there?
Yeah, so it starts in April and runs through to July. And then there's this is the painting residency. And then there's like a photographic based one that runs afterwards. And it's like a 4-month period of making, which is rad. How often does that happen? And then with a presentation at the Sargent Gallery between, you know, that'll be decided between 2027 and 2029. Yeah, but it was kind of a follow-on from what happened at the Douse and works that I would like to make, extending this idea of like creating, sort of riffing on heritage, but creating some sort of new form of itoke object that sits somewhere between sculpture and painting. I also wanted to look more at textile-based works.
Mm.
There's doormats in Fiji, which are like rag rugs using like bullet shirt offcuts. Yeah, looking at some other forms that the paintings could potentially take. Like it's still very much painting. Like this is ultimately what I talk about works being sculpture and yada yada. I'll always be a painter.
Yeah.
Painter make it. You know? So it's like, it'll always come back to, it's just painting in different types. Ways and form, like dyeing fabric or adding it. Yeah. So yeah, it would very much be a painting-based project, looking at different forms and eventually coming up with some sort of show.
Exciting. Yeah. And as well, later in the year, I understand you're heading down to Hastings Art Gallery as well.
Yep,
can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that will be with Kurumi Kiddo, who's an assistant curator there, working in the foyer space. I think it will be potentially some of the Thewa Vonuvonu works, which are based on Fijian breastplates. They're like pearl and whalebone breastplates that I've made these shells with stands that kind of mimic that form, but my take on them. There was also my dad's cousin in, this is an aside, in Sabu Sabu runs a pearl farm. So one of my first experiences when we went back was jumping off the boat and so swimming amongst the pearl kind of. So there's this, that's when I started using the shells when I was thinking back about these kind of moments. Yeah, so that'll be based on a similar sort of thing. I think some of the experimentation from Tylee will inevitably kind of pop in there, but it was meant to be based on some of those works from the Douse.
Nerve-wracking, but exciting.
Yeah, it's always that process where you're quite, you know, figure it out.
Yeah. It'll come to you. Don't worry about
surely,
it.
Surely.
Don't worry about it. Hey, it's been so beautiful chatting about the show and your practice. I guess to end our kōrero, did you have any hopes for viewers engaging with the show who go see that at Melanie Roger Gallery?
Yeah, I think I've always enjoyed work. You know, if there's a level of generosity in work where it can be engaged with on multiple levels, like I think there can be a thing when viewing artwork where it can feel a little bit closed off or in an echo chamber about its own making. But my own practice, I'm quite invested in this idea of if somebody wants to come and engage with it and think, oh, that's funny or pretty, or that's equally as valid as if you're not, you know, if you're interested in why and the heritage behind the work and the lineage, you know, I think that's what I would want to extend as a sense of kind of manaaki of like, come, have a look. you know, you can engage with it how you choose.
That was artist Claudia Jowett speaking to me about her solo exhibition Ur Levu, currently on at Melanie Roger Gallery. The show is on now until the 2nd of April.
What's it all for?
Various artists.
Thank you.
Well, hello there, Mr. Fiber. Would you like to go to the party? Oh, hello, Mrs. Ferment. Welcome to the function. Moo moo to you too, Yogurt. Want a party? Just kidding, I know you do.
Good news! You can go to the Gut Health Party too by tuning in to 95BFM Drive and listening for your cue to enter. Gut Health, live at Whammy Bar, Thursday, March 26th. Tickets on sale now from under the radar.
Carhartt Work in Progress has just unleashed Audio Archives,
a collaboration with 17 independent radio stations from around the world, including your faves, 95BFM.
Audio Archives is a celebration of independent radio and includes a printed publication, a capsule collection, and a global program of radio broadcasts and events.
Check out all the details at carhartt-wip.com and search for Audio Archives.
More info to be announced.
All right, you four Muppets, listen up. I finally pinpointed 95BFM's weak spot, Friday night, 7 till 9pm. The staff have all gone to watch Rick Breeze play water polo, so that's when we're going to strike. Phil, you're cracking the safe. Grenade, you're disabling the alarm. Pat Fife, you load this BFM CD library into this sack. And Professor, you're driving the getaway van. Kushti. They're never going to see this coming.
Gang of Four, every Friday night from 7 till 9pm, with a revolving cast of bona fide BFM legends, Renee, Pat, Phil and the Professor are putting the B into TBIF. Gang of Four, thanks to Verona, the heart of Karanga Happy Road.
The original originator.
25.
You can listen to us while you're at home doing some chores, or you can take us along for company while you're driving in your car.
Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
Yes, darling, but is it art?
Jude Stevens is a Tamaki-based artist who works amongst a practice of sculptural installation and photography. His work often both circulating and reflecting on various materials and structures that are connected to Aotearoa's colonial histories. His current exhibition on at Room Goldie's Grove presents a sculptural installation of found uku and fallen kauri that reflects on the colonial implications of Goldie's Bush, an area with a rich history of mass kauri deforestation, as well as experiencing the ongoing effects of kauri dieback, a soil-borne pathogen. Stephen draws from these histories and offers up a beautiful installation that seeks to honour these raw treasured materials and their individual histories. I caught up with Jude about the show and overall practice.
My name's Jude Stevens. I'm a sculptor and photographer at times. My practice really focuses on materials, specific sort of materials, often found materials, often recycled materials. I like to kind of rebuild structures and make objects and installations that sort of speak to kind of the material itself, but also sort of like kind of histories the materials have been sort of entwined with, like in colonial history. Sometimes I take photos sort of to, in a way, kind of capture moments of myself collecting materials or of the materials themselves to kind of speak to similar ideas. Like often I kind of combine both the different disciplines together. Yeah.
Beautiful. And your current exhibition on at Room Goldie's Grove presents a sculptural installation of found uku and kauri that reflects on the colonial implications of Goldie's Bush. I wanted to start this conversation by speaking to the beginnings of this project, the kind of footings and initial thoughts behind this work. What drew you to this circulation of Goldie's Bush for this work?
I guess going right back to the kind of start of the project, I'd like just moved home after studying down in Dunedin at the Dunedin School of Art. I grew up and I live in Midway, right sort of like on the boundary of Goldie's Bush. So yeah, I've been lucky enough to sort of be brought up around kind of the native forested area. And I came back home and sort of with sort of all the stuff I'd kind of learned and sort of the sort of making that I was doing at art school, I kind of like realized the sort of confliction of like what has kind of happened in this bush I've grown up next to, like with its history of deforestation, and then now forests being closed due to sort of coldy dieback. And sort of, yeah, like that's where the project first kind of seeded from, I guess.
And through the making process of the show, this approach to Goldie's Bush and its history of mass Cody deforestation, through this artistic lens and context, I wanted to ask, what has this process of reflection been like for you through the making of this exhibition?
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting because it sort of started off as this kind of, I guess, playful idea of collecting fallen branches and kind of just simply trying to stand them back up as if they were a tree again, kind of collecting the clay which they had fallen kind of onto. And that simple idea of, yeah, like replanting a stick back into the ground, as simple as that. And then sort of as like it developed, I kind of started realizing how sort of profound it was to be using both like the material of found clay and myself as the maker kind of excavating this land, and then also using these fallen branches, which have like kind of, the reason they're falling is due to sort of potentially my own presence on this land and on this property. So it's kind of like this combination of them like sort of looking deeper into the materials and then pulling it like right back, simplifying it.
Yeah, and I also wanted to delve into the actual making process of this work. Can you tell me a little bit about what went into the making of this work? What did that physical process kind of look like for you?
Yeah, so the most sort of like physically sort of intensive side of the work itself was the clay. Obviously, it's 18 bricks worth of clay, which are unfired, and sort of getting your head around digging up that much clay is actually like quite a large amount of material.
Yeah.
So it was just like using a shovel and a wheelbarrow and kind of finding pockets of clay like within the sort of within the bush area like on the property, and I'll just have to first like break the clay down, which is like a very like sort of interesting process of kind of adding water, and then it's very like, you know, you're using your whole body, you're really pushing kind of the rocks and debris out to try to get a sort of smoother material that you can then form. I actually kind of looked into the history of like making bricks, and I used the traditional method of like, I made a wooden, like a wooden mold. I'll just sort of put the clay into slabs and then press them into this mold. So then like each brick was kind of obviously the same dimension. Also, it was kind of like this quite interesting, yeah, kind of becoming a brick maker. It was quite an interesting experience. And I don't know, it was enjoyable, but also it was kind of like realizing how much goes into making a brick, which is like quite overwhelming to think about the amount of land that goes into building a building built with bricks, you know?
Yeah. Was the form always going to be a brick that held the Cody?
It actually started off as like a kind of three-dimensional form. Like it wasn't necessarily a brick as such. It was kind of like more of like a rectangular sort of cubic form. And then I was kind of like realizing, I was like, what is it that I'm really trying to say here? Like the Cody itself is so sculptural in its own way. Like kind of combining it with something that's sort of a little bit more recognizable, or a little bit more, I guess, like structural, just kind of like made sense. And then also, like, I guess when you're looking at the work itself, it's like all the bricks are the same height, so it kind of gives you this idea of like the floor of the forest or something, you know what I mean, rather than kind of having these like different sort of ups and downs. Yeah, it was a decision I made like for aesthetics, but also like conceptually it just tied in quite nicely.
Yeah, because it made quite a uniform platform, so you could really see the difference in the Cody sticks and their own forms and such.
Yeah, exactly. Cody itself, like the process of that was quite lovely, because it was kind of, I was trying to really sort of let the each sort of fallen branch and sort of smaller chunks like to really be as they kind of were found. So it was like stripping the Cody back just with a draw knife, and then sanding and using a spoke shave to kind of get them nice and round and uniform. But it was like, yeah, it was nice not trying to like push too hard into it.
And do you want to speak a little bit more to the significance of the raw materials used, as well as why it was important for you and the work to engage with those specific materials?
Yeah, so the materials themselves are obviously very significant to like to the place in which I live, but also kind of it speaks to the sort of the effect the forest has had with colonization. Like in the early 1900s, the forest was kind of devastated due to mass deforestation, along with like a lot of the rest of the Waitakere forest. The colony was used for kind of infrastructure and building materials kind of in that early sort of like rise of Auckland. And then after the bush kind of had been fully cleared of all its mature kauri, which was a similar time to when David Goldie himself passed away, who was Auckland mayor and at the time and kind of the man in charge of the operation. He kind of gifted the forest, the bush, to the council, and then it became a reserve, which became like walking tracks and I guess like a recreational kind of area. And then obviously jumping forward, like this sort of like exposure to the public came along with the kauri dieback disease, which is still very apparent and actually quite visible from the view from the forest that I have. And obviously the trees that are sort of surrounding our place and on our property. So yeah, the use of the material was kind of this idea of like standing these affected kauri back up. And then obviously referencing the title of the work, like Goldie's Grove, it's kind of like almost a take on like, this is kind of what has happened. This is kind of a representation of like standing back up these fallen trees. Yeah, and it kind of references, I guess, like the forest we are more familiar with now, which is the sort of pine forest, kind of putting them in rows. Kind of, there's a few things kind of entwined, but yeah, mostly it's kind of like, yeah, it's talking about these damaged and dead kind of trees, yeah, being stood back up, being planted back into the ground that they'd kind of fallen from, yeah.
And I also wanted to speak about the installation of this work. It's really beautiful. When I went in, the sun was beaming in and casting these really stunning shadows on the floor. And the work itself is quite organized within its placement, arranged in this line and grid-like structure. You briefly mentioned it just before, but do you want to speak a little bit to the installation of this work and the kind of logic behind this grid-like formation within the gallery space?
Yeah, so the installation itself kind of, like I, from the get-go when I decided that the work was going to become a physical thing, I was fascinated and yeah, this idea of like kind of creating like a grid, kind of pulling completely away from the sort of organicness of a normal kauri forest. And yeah, like having the bricks all the same height, it kind of gives a sort of idea of like, the bricks being almost like these little pinpoints on the floor of the gallery, and then the kauri sort of sprouting up from them, and like it kind of just let the kauri kind of have their own little unique thing going on, with some hitting the roof and some kind of barely just kind of sticking out from the clay forms. But yeah, it was like kind of a, I guess the grid was a kind of a way of keeping the work in a kind of uniform way, so that it didn't like seem too random or like kind of too all over the place. I wanted to like people to know that there was kind of like some thought that went into like the concept and the way the exhibition felt, yeah.
And I also wanted to ask, what do you feel is important about this work and its ideas for contemporary audiences now? What about Aotearoa today would benefit from experiencing this work?
the importance to me personally is like myself as a Pākehā artist kind of responding to being and growing up on a piece of land and kind of realizing and maybe accepting that, like, yeah, I'm a part of this sort of like history of New Zealand colonization. Like, these materials are very, very treasured to whenua Māori, obviously, and like the work itself, like, is going to go back to where it came from. And I guess like that kind of speaks to sort of sustainability as well. I feel like there's a lot of waste in the sort of contemporary art world. It's kind of nice making something which comes from the land and then it goes back. I look at the materials as something that, like, I guess I'm borrowing. It's like they're not necessarily like mine. I guess to me, like, that's something important and something that should be thought about.
That was Jude Stevens speaking to me about Goldie's Grove, which is currently on at Room until the 11th of April.
Only positive critiques. Honest.
Various artists.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Various Artists. Keep it on the beat.
Protect you.
It's the 95 BFM Art Guide on various artists.
It's paintings in that.
This week in the wonderful world of art in Tamaki Makaurau. As mentioned on the show, Goldie's Grove by Jude Stevens is on at Room. Also on at Room is Get Ready With Me, a group show by Aria McInnes, Kiani Reifa, and Rita Takuchi. Both are on at Room until the 11th of April.
Also mentioned on the show, Claudia Jowett's solo exhibition Ualevu is on at Melanie Roger Gallery until the 2nd of April.
Opening tonight from 5:30 to 7:30 is Anto Yaldizian's Desert Island at Coastal Signs, as well as Zach Langdon Pohl's Caterpillar Soup at Let Thomas Gallery, so head along to both of those if you can.
Life Stories, a solo exhibition by Marie Shannon, is on at Trish Clark Gallery until the 2nd of May.
Amon Nakuru, Telltale, a Dog, is on at Te Uru Waitakere Contemporary Gallery until the 17th of May.
Dreaming From Afar, a group show exhibiting Brunel Diaz-Prims, Gyan Manik, and Tyrone Tewa, is on at Gus Fisher Gallery until the 2nd of May.
And Gordon Bennett and Emily Karaka, After the Undercurrents, is on at Artspace Aotearoa until the 11th of April. If you have something you want on the Art Guide, you can email us at arts@95bfm.com.
That was the 95BFM Art Guide.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's all for various artists for today. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us today.
Claudia Jowett.
And Jude Stevens.
Nei rā, hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95bfm.com or check out our Instagram at 95bfm various artists for more.
Ka hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. Next up is The Land of the Good Groove with Mari. My name is Soph.
I'm Maya.
And that was various artists.
We'll catch you next week.
You're listening to 95BFM. BFM. Keep it on the B.
Kakite.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.